The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Rendell.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, it is Thursday. We're almost at the end of the week, but not quite there yet. I'm Nicole Sandler. Welcome to the program. As you know, we try to start off the show each day with a little bit of the funny. Now, yesterday, I got a lot of feedback on that Parody Project song we played at the start of the show. It certainly wasn't funny, but it was, the word I keep using, poignant. Today, though, we go back to the funny. We turn to the one, the only, Samantha Bee, who was talking about the fact that the first Democratic debates of the 2020 campaign season are less than a week away.
With 20 candidates set to take the stage, you think that the Democratic Party is just letting anyone in. But in reality, there are some candidates who didn't make the cutoff, such as Montana governor and man who will sell your house today, Steve Bullock. Bullock is currently polling around 0%, possibly because no one knows who the fuck he is. For example, I first learned of Steve Bullock by reading his name off this teleprompter 30 seconds ago. But even though he's a pointless presidential candidate, Bullock is pretty popular in his home state. In the same year that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 20 points in Montana, Bullock actually won against his Republican opponent by 4 points. Which brings me to make a delicate request. Run for Senate, goddammit!
Yes!
Presidency would be great, but real change is impossible unless the Senate changes hands too. Bullock is just one of many Democrats wasting his time in a presidential race who could be way more useful running for something else. You'd think people would be lining up to run for Senate, but it turns out Chuck Schumer is being served rejection after rejection from the party's biggest hopes. One former Senate aide suggested that good candidates don't want to run for Senate because it's so toxic and polarized, which I assume is a euphemism for fuck, I don't want to work with Mitch McConnell. But that is exactly why we need good Democratic candidates for Senate. The beauty of elections is if you run and win, then you're the Mitch McConnell.
Kind of, sort of.
Presidential candidate and former star of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, John Hickenlooper, says he's not cut out to run for senator in Colorado.
Those of us that become energized and really electrified by working with talented people and taking on things that people say are impossible and then getting them done. The Senate doesn't attract me at this point. Just doesn't attract me.
It doesn't attract you? Well, 99.7% of Democratic presidential voters aren't attracted to you. My God.
That is true.
Is he still so confident? Is this what it's like to be a man? I barely have the confidence to go buy cereal without putting on makeup first. John Hickenlooper, run for Senate. Colorado's Cory Gardner is one of the most vulnerable GOP senators this year. You have a good shot against him. And you literally have a 0.3% shot at being nominated for president. My feet are polling better than that on WikiFeet, and my dad was a hobbit. Flipping the Senate won't be easy, but it isn't impossible. Democrats will have to defend all 12 of their current seats and pick up 4 more. Mm. There are a few possibilities, including Maine, where total guys girl Susan Collins is up for re-election. Collins's approval rating has dipped 15 points in the last 2 years, largely due to her votes for Brett Kavanaugh and other anti-abortion judges. Voters were so frustrated, in fact, that they raised millions for her challenger before a challenger even announced. Luckily, Maine House Speaker Sarah Gideon is expected to take on Collins. Hopefully, she'll kick Collins out of office, giving her more time to gaslight sexual assault victims face-to-face. Unfortunately, Democrats are often reluctant to run races they probably can't win, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't try. Just look at Iowa Senator and Kate Gosselin's hair burglar, Joni Ernst.
Must we?
Sure, Ernst is going to be hard to beat. She's a right-wing Iowan who carries a pistol in her purse and brags about castrating pigs as a child. But Iowa's been hit hard by Trump's tariffs. Maybe they'll go for a Democrat who cares about free trade and only has plans to castrate one big pig.
I meant to hit the applause button, not the buzzer, because yes, she only has plans to castrate one big pig. A little bit of Samantha Bee from last night, and I know I got all the comments from the YouTube chat room. Samantha Bee is kind of a Bernie hater, and it's the one thing I don't like about her. But my God, she's so right about this. All of these bottom tier candidates, the Steve Bullocks. Well, Seth Moulton doesn't need to run for Senate. He just needs to drop out. Some of these others, the what's his name from Colorado, Corey, I don't even know. The guy from Colorado. These people, I don't even know their names. They should run for Senate. Beto O'Rourke should run for Senate. We need them in the Senate. Anyway. A bit of Samantha Bee from last night. And thank you to Samantha Bee for remaining on the air now that we are entering into summer. Because, you know, a lot of these shows, they take the summer off. How dare they? Don't they know we're at an existential crisis in America? We need our funny. We do. So I'll do my best to help you with that as we move forward. Sometimes more successful than others. Anyway. Today's Thursday. Thursdays, as you know, we usually are joined, Cory Gardner, thank you, Dwayne Nickerson. We're usually joined by our pal Howie Klein from Down with Tyranny. He's taking the day off, but we have a great guest in his stead today, and that is Wendell Potter. And perhaps you remember Wendell Potter. Now, if you've been a listener of progressive talk radio for any amount of time, then you do know Wendell Potter. In fact, I first met him 10 years ago. August. Well, I first heard of him almost exactly 10 years ago now, because it was almost a decade ago to the day, June 24th, today's the 20th, 2009, when former VP of Communications for Cigna testified as a whistleblower before the Senate Commerce Committee about the deceptive practices employed by the health insurance industry. It was right around the time as when the fight for the Affordable Care Act was beginning. Back in those days, I was doing a nightly show on Air America Radio. So, in fact, after seeing Wendell Potter testify before Congress and then go on with Bill Moyers, where he did his first interview after testifying, I'm like, oh my God, this is the guy. We need to talk to him. So I went in search of getting Wendell Potter on my show, and sure enough, I did. It was August 5th, 2009. That Wendell Potter was on my Air America radio show. And, you know, I went back through my podcast archives and searched Wendell Potter. And sure enough, a slew of interviews came up because I've had the opportunity to speak to him many times over the years. But the first time was August 5th, 2009, again, during the Air America days. And he stayed in touch throughout the whole fight for the Affordable Care Act. Well, now we're moving ahead. We're moving ahead to Medicare for All. And there was a big poll released earlier this week, I think on Tuesday. It was done by the Kaiser Family Foundation that found that most Americans are confused or seriously ill-informed about Medicare for All. So I thought, who better to talk to about this than Wendell Potter? So stick around. Wendell will be with us at the bottom of the hour. We'll have a nice extended conversation. We'll also find out what's happening with tarbell.org, the new news organization site, a nonprofit, independent news organization that that he helped, that he founded. So we'll talk about a lot of stuff with Wendell Potter. Always, always excited to speak with him. But there is a lot going on in the news today. So I guess now's a good time as any to launch into what's news. And okay, it's Thursday. Not that that means anything, but we'll do a live.
I read the news today. Oh boy.
We'll do it live. Fucking thing.
Okay.
We'll do it live.
We'll do it live. Fuck. All right. Well, don't get so angry, Bill. I get that you're angry, but and maybe he's angry about this. The Senate today voted on a resolution blocking the U.S. export of defense weapons and services to Saudi Arabia, mostly, and some other countries are involved in this deal, too. Great Britain and Northern Ireland are among them. And believe it or not, seven Republicans joined with all the Democrats to vote yes, passing this measure, the first resolution, by a vote of 53 to 45. In case you're wondering who those seven Republicans are, Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham, Mike Lee, Jerry Moron. I know it's Moran of Kansas, but Moron, it just works better. Lisa Murkowski, Rand Paul, and somebody young. Those are the seven Republicans who backed off, actually. There were three votes. The first and second resolutions of disapproval passed 53 to 45. A third vote covering the remaining 20 resolutions was 51 to 45, which sadly means they will not be able to overturn a Trump veto, which is expected. So final, at least, look, hey, little cracks in the armor, and seven Republican senators voted to keep Trump from selling arms to the Saudis. Yeah. Stay tuned, because this isn't over. There's a lot more. On top of that, there's more news in the tensions rising with Iran. In fact, hold on. Let me share this with you over here, because Iran shot down a U.S. drone, a naval surveillance drone. That was a big drone, not one of those little helicoptery things that you can buy, but it's the size of an airplane. It has the wingspan of an airliner, and it was shot down near the Strait of Hormuz early this morning, obviously escalating tensions in the Persian Gulf region and prompting the White House to call an emergency meeting with top congressional leaders. That's happening this afternoon. Okay. Trump today met with Justin Trudeau, Canada's prime minister. And while the press was gathered in the Oval Office, Trump was asked about the shooting down of the drone. Right. And if this is going to lead to war, because obviously his advisors, you know, the John Boltons of the administration, want nothing more than war with Iran. But Donald Trump, I got to tell you, for all his tough guy positioning, his love of strong men and despots, he's look, I'm glad he's taking this tack. But oh, my God, I think Donald Trump is scared shitless of getting into a war with Iran. I think he understands that, you know, this would be bad. And there's a chance that we could be blown up into oblivion. There is. Anyway, so listen to this. I know you don't like hearing Donald Trump audio, but this is just mind-blowing audio here. So it was from the Oval Office. Justin Trudeau is sitting right there, and Donald Trump is asked about Iran shooting down this drone. And just listen to this exchange.
Mr. President, you said Iran is a different country. Do you still hold that opinion?
Oh, absolutely. When I came here, Iran was in 14 to 18 different sites of confliction. They were extremely hostile.
All right. So I'm pausing this because I want to make sure you heard. The question was, you say that Iran is now a different country than it was when you took office. So here he is claiming that all of a sudden they've come around to being, you know, I guess, friends. I don't know. You try to figure out what the fuck he's saying here.
They were hostile when they signed the deal. They were screaming death to America. And I think probably Iran made a mistake. I would imagine it was a general or somebody that made a mistake in shooting that drone down. And fortunately, that drone was unarmed. It was not, there was no man in it. And there was
there was no man in it. Fortunately, that drone, it was unarmed. Oh, I mean, there was no man in it. If there were a man in it, it would not be a drone. Kind of simple, but it just, oh my God, he's such a fucking idiot. Okay, sorry. I've composed myself again. All right, so tell us more, Donald, please. There was no man in it.
No, it was just, it was over international waters, clearly over international waters, but we didn't have a man or woman in the drone. We had nobody in the drone.
There was nobody in the drone.
Would have made a big difference, let me tell you. Would have made a big, big.
Yeah, because it wouldn't be a drone. Oh, my God. What, America, what have you done to us? This is the fucking idiot who is sitting in the Oval Office. He doesn't know that a drone is not manned. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Big difference. But I have a feeling.
Yeah?
I may be wrong, and I may be right, but I'm right a lot.
No, you're not.
I have a feeling that it was a mistake made by somebody that shouldn't have been doing what they did.
Who do you think
did I think they made a mistake. And I'm not just talking to the country made a mistake. I think that somebody under the command of that country made a big mistake.
You're talking to Iran's leader.
Okay, so he's excusing them.
Let's just see what happens.
Let's see what happens.
It's all going to work out.
So you're saying you think it wasn't intentional?
Say it. I don't know. I find it hard to believe it was intentional, if you want to know the truth. I think that it could have been somebody who was loose and stupid.
Somebody who was loose and stupid?
Be able to report back. And you'll understand exactly what happened. But it was a very foolish move. That I can tell you.
He is a fucking moron. He is just an idiot who has no business being on a White House tour, let alone occupying the Oval Office. Oh, my God. The world is laughing at us. They're laughing at us. This would be hysterically funny if it weren't so terrifyingly frightening. Oh, my God. That stands on its own. I don't know what else to say about that. Amazing. All right. To keep on the Iran tensions story, the House Foreign Affairs Committee held a hearing yesterday about whether the administration believes that the authorization for use of military force that was passed approving a war over the 9/11 attacks gives it the authority to attack Iran, because that's what they're claiming. Of course, we know the Obama administration used the 9/11 AUMF to launch its military attacks. I'm looking for something less oppositional there. Their patrols, whatever. So Obama was wrong in using that 9/11 AUMF to justify military incursions. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for. But this is insane. How many years ago was that already? Anyway, so a guy named Brian Hook, he's the senior State Department official on Iran issues. He was being questioned when it was Congressman Ted Lieu's turn to ask the question. Now, again, the hearing was about whether or not this administration can use the 9/11 AUMF to wage war with Iran. So Ted Lieu, of course, was getting nowhere with his questioning of this guy, Brian Hook, the senior State Department official on Iran, when he changed his course of questioning. Just listen to this exchange.
Under our Constitution, does the president have the power to declare war?
I think this is a discussion.
It's not a trick question. Again. Under our Constitution, does the president have the power to declare war? It's just a yes or no.
All right.
Let me make it really easy for you. Under the Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war, correct?
Yes. Yes.
It's not a trick question, sir.
Not a trick question.
Have you read the Constitution?
We will do everything we are required to do.
Mr. Hook, have you read the Constitution?
I have read the Constitution.
Okay. Under the Constitution, The framers gave Congress the power to declare a war, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Just a yes or no.
This is my understanding is that we're here to talk about Iran foreign policy, which
oh
I can
God.
Do.
Under the Constitution, the framers gave Congress
on war powers. I believe
okay.
we should have.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I'm going to stop this line of questioning. I'm going to submit the U.S. Constitution for the record.
Oh, my God.
Without objection.
And so there's whoever the chairman of the committee was, without objection. Ted Lieu submitted the U.S. Constitution for the congressional record because the senior State Department official on Iran issues couldn't answer the question about who has the power in government to declare war. Oh, my God. Okay, so last night, just a little more on this issue. Last night, Dolt 45 called into Sean Hannity's television show because he's got nothing better to do with his time, right? Hannity told Trump that he was worried about the situation with Iran. Trump's response was just laughable.
I worry about Iranian hegemony. I worry about Iranian proxy wars and terror. I worry about their alliance with Vladimir Putin. And I'm not sure where China shakes out in all of this. As you look at the geopolitical work up there, Iran, Russia, China, tell me your concerns.
Don't worry about a thing. Everything's
don't
under control.
About a
don't
thing.
Worry about a thing.
Let's see.
You said Iran is a different country. Do you still hold that opinion?
Oh, hold on. I'm playing the wrong game.
Don't you worry about a thing.
I expected him to break out in song. Okay, what a, again, at the risk of repeating myself, what a fucking moron. Don't worry about a thing. You're threatening to start World War III, but don't worry about a thing. Okay. In other news, in Great Britain, they've narrowed down their... in the quest for a new prime minister, whoever heads up the Conservative Party, it is now down to two candidates, they being Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt. They are competing in the UK Conservative runoff to become Britain's next prime minister. Oy. All right. In other news, and you know this story again, but I guess I have to repeat it because it's a big story today. The Gaffe King did it again. Former Vice President Joe Biden has refused to apologize for his remarks about working with unapologetically segregationist colleagues in the Senate. The remarks in question came at a New York City fundraiser Tuesday night when, in an attempt to explain that how he believes in working across the aisle, Biden told a story he's told before, and it's one which his advisors have warned him repeatedly to stop repeating. Instead of heeding their advice, Biden cited the late senators, James Eastland of Missouri, or Mississippi, one of the two, and Herman Talmadge of Georgia, who were both segregationists, steadfastly opposed to civil rights and racial integration. According to pool reports, Biden said, quote, I was in a caucus with James Eastland, and then he launched into a southern drawl to say, he never called me boy, he always called me son. Maybe, Joe, just maybe, it's because boy is a racial epithet they use against black men, and you're white. So they didn't call you boy. Of Talmadge, he said, quote, he's one of the meanest guys I've ever known. But at least there was some civility. We didn't agree on much of anything, but we got things done. The response was swift. Senator Cory Booker said that Joe Biden needs to apologize.
Are you going to apologize like Cory Booker
apologize
has called
for what?
Cory Booker has called for it.
Oh, wait, but here's Cory Booker. Sorry.
You know, the vice president said I should know better, and this is what I know. As a black man in America, I know the deeply harmful and hurtful usage of the word boy and how it was used to dehumanize and degrade. I know that segregationists like the two people here are talking about through their laws and their language deeply wounded this nation, and the present day manifestations of their work can still be seen in black and brown communities like the one I go home to. I know that somebody running for president of the United States somebody running to be the leader of our party should know that using the word boy in the way he did can cause hurt and pain. And we need a presidential nominee and the leader of our party to be sensitive to that. And the last thing I know is I know that I was raised to speak truth to power and that I will never apologize for doing that. And Vice President Biden shouldn't need this lesson.
Nope.
And at a time when we have from the highest offices in the land, divisiveness, racial hatred,
yep,
and bigotry being spewed, he should have the sensitivity to know that this is a time I need to be an ally. I need to be a healer. I need to not engage in usage of words that will harm folks. And so this is deeply disappointing. We waited for him to apologize. He didn't till the next day. And whether I'm running for president or not, as many people today have been on Juneteenth, no less, calling out for the vice president to acknowledge that his words were harmful and hurtful.
Right. So then Joe Biden was out and about and a reporter asked him about an apology.
Are you going to apologize? Like Cory Booker has called
for what?
Apologize for what?
Cory should apologize. He knows better. I'm not a racist bone in my body. I've been involved in civil rights my whole life. Career.
Yeah.
Period.
Sure.
Period. Period.
Period. I could have, but I didn't pull a lot of audio that's floating around the interwebs today of Joe Biden during the hearings in 1993 on the crime bill when he talked about predators. Remember Hillary Clinton and the super predators comments? Well, Joe Biden said all that and worse. We can pull that out. Period. Oy. Again, as Cory Booker mentioned, adding insult to injury, Biden's comments came on the eve of Juneteenth, the anniversary of the day on which the last of the slaves in the U.S. were officially freed. And I talked to you about yesterday, we spent, well, the whole show, basically, talking about, Juneteenth and the hearing in the House Judiciary Subcommittee, on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. In which they were, you know, talking about reparations. Author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's credited for the resurgence of the idea of reparations in his 2014 missive in The Atlantic, The Case for Reparations, was a witness. He took aim at Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Yesterday, when asked about reparations, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell offered a familiar reply. America should not be held liable for something that happened 150 years ago, since none of us currently alive are responsible. This rebuttal proffers a strange theory of governance, that American accounts are somehow bound by the lifetime of its generations. But well into this century, the United States was still paying out pensions to the heirs of Civil War soldiers. We honor treaties that date back some 200 years, despite no one being alive who signed those treaties. Enslavement reigned for 250 years on these shores. When it ended, this country could have extended its hallowed principles, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to all regardless of color. But America had other principles in mind. And so for a century after the Civil War, black people were subjected to a relentless campaign of terror, a campaign that extended well into the lifetime of Majority Leader McConnell. But this committee must know is that while emancipation dead-bolted the door against the bandits of America, Jim Crow wedged the windows wide open. And that is the thing about Senator McConnell's something. It was 150 years ago, and it was right now.
That was Ta-Nehisi Coates, who just spoke so eloquently at that hearing yesterday. I did include a link on yesterday's blog entry with yesterday's podcast to the entirety of that hearing yesterday, the video of it from C-SPAN, which I highly recommend, even if you just watch the opening statements. But the whole thing is really worth a view. It's, good stuff. All right. As I told you at the beginning of the show, Thursdays are usually Howie Klein days here at the Nicole Sandler Show. Howie is taking the day off. Today, instead, we are going to explore. Hold on. Why is this not going? United States, yes. I was so good that I shit. I hate this computer. There we go. All right. So we're calling Wendell Potter. Wendell Potter, again, as I mentioned, is a former vice president of communications in the health insurance industry. He worked at Cigna when he had a revelation, a change of view of life. And it was a decade ago this week. It was June 24th, 2009, that Wendell Potter testified as a whistleblower before the Senate Commerce Committee about the deceptive practices employed by the health insurance industry. It was sort of a lead up to the days when we were fighting over the Affordable Care Act, when Wendell Potter emerged as a hero to those of us who were fighting for real health care in America as opposed to our system of for-profit health insurance. Hey, Wendell Potter, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Nicole.
Hi.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Did you realize it was 10 years ago this week that you testified before Senate? Yeah.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I had forgotten, wasn't it? I mean, that was obviously, I certainly should remember because it was probably the most important day, certainly of my career and probably my life as well.
Right. Well, it's when you, I mean, you had been, let's relive history for a minute because we're talking 10 years here. You were the VP of communications for Cigna and you had a change of heart. Basically, your story was you went to one of Stan Brock's remote medical clinics that he's since died, that he used to run around the country.
Yeah.
Can you tell us that story?
That's right. In fact, that also was in June, and I went down to visit my family. I read the newspaper about this. They call it an expedition in the newspaper,
right.
And that's what Stan's group, I guess, still calls these clinics, because Stan organized, he formed this organization called Remote Area Medical to fly doctors from the U.S. on expeditions to developing countries, to very remote villages in Africa and South America and other places. But demand got to be so great in this country that he started having these clinics in the United States. Now most of them are now held here.
Yep.
When I read about it, I was so intrigued, I decided to borrow my dad's car and drive up there, just really, Nicole, out of curiosity. And I was, I'll never forget the moment that I walked through the gates of the Wise County Fairgrounds. It was in Southwest Virginia, just a few miles from Kingsport, Tennessee, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I was just overcome, actually, with emotion when I saw this scene of hundreds and hundreds of people who were lined up waiting to get care in barns and animal stalls.
Wow.
On this fairground.
These are Americans who could not afford health care, who did not have insurance, who would show up at these medical expeditions. That's right. That's what he called them. Through his organization that he founded, Remote Area Medical, that, as you said, Wendell Potter, he used to take to third world countries to help provide medical care for people there who didn't have it. Now his organization moved to mostly rural communities around the U.S. where lines would go on what appear to be for miles. There was no shortage of patients for these events. And
that's true.
And so that changed your way of thinking? It made you reexamine what you were doing for a living?
It did, because I realized that what I was doing for a living as a spokesman for the health insurance industry and a propagandist, really, which I came to realize I was playing a role in making that scene necessary. And I had to take some responsibility for it. And I also realized if I hadn't been lucky, I could have been one of those people, because I grew up near there. And people in those lines could have been people that I grew up with, and even people I was related to. And I knew also that what I was doing for a living was the exact opposite of what I tried to do in my first career. I was a newspaper reporter, a journalist in my first career. And I had a longer career in corporate public relations. And it dawned on me while I was standing there that I was doing, what I was doing was perpetuating a healthcare system that was so dysfunctional and was so expensive. And at that time, we had 50 million Americans who didn't have insurance and a growing number of people who are underinsured. And that's still a problem today. I went back, actually, to a remote area medical expedition just last month, and I was saddened to see that they're still needed and the lines are as long as ever. Mm. And a lot of the people in those lines are insured. They just have plans with very high deductibles. They can't afford to pay out of pocket for the care that they need.
You know, I'm jumping ahead now, but just along those lines, my daughter is now 20. For years, she had insurance through Florida's Children's Health Insurance Plan, the SCHIP program. And so it was taken care of. When she turned 18, she aged out of that, and I'm on Obamacare, so I had to get her a policy. Her policy, she's a healthy 20-year-old. Her premium with the subsidy, because she's got a decent job, is, I think, about $200 a month. But she's got a $7,000 deductible, and her co-pays are insane to see a specialist at $65. It shouldn't be that way. And I know that's why you are these days working to advocate for Medicare for All. And frankly, that's the reason why I wanted to have you on the show today, because there was a new poll released on Tuesday by the Kaiser Family Foundation that found that most Americans are confused or ill-informed about Medicare for All. Now, in the decade since we first met you, Wendell, 10 years ago, you appeared before Congress, and then you sat for an interview with Bill Moyers that got all of us paying attention. And that's when I decided I needed to talk to you, and I started reaching out to you. At the time, I was on Air America Radio, and you came on with me. It was August 5th, 2009, which was the first time we spoke. And I was fortunate enough to have you on as a guest throughout the whole process of passing the Affordable Care Act. You've written a few books, most notably Deadly Spin, which tells about your whole transition and passing the Affordable Care Act, to Whistleblower. And then you also founded the reader-funded independent nonprofit news site that covers money and politics and policy, Tarbell.org. You've been busy because you're also now serving as president of the Business Initiative for Healthcare for Health Policy that is focused on advancing Medicare for All.
That's exactly right. I've been a lot busier in the last few years and even the last few months than I ever was in my old career.
Wow.
I've often said that I need to make amends. So I'm very busy doing that still. But Tarbell is I think a very important journalism organization that focuses on exposing corruption in big corporations and special interests and big corporations like the ones that I used to work for and big pharmaceutical companies. And I more recently have agreed to serve as president, as you noted, of the Business Initiative for Health Policy. And we make the business case for moving to Medicare for All. When we first talked back in August of 2009, as you recall, nobody was talking or given a hearing on Capitol Hill if you were supporting single payer health care. But we've had a sea change since then, and I give a lot of credit to Bernie Sanders because he campaigned on it in 2016. Or 2018, and what was it, 2016, I guess it was.
2016, right.
But anyway, he put it on the map, and people have really embraced the idea. To your point, there is a lot of confusion about what it is, and to be honest, I think part of the reason is because Democrats who are not fully in the Medicare for All camp have proposed legislation that you might call Medicare Lite or something like that, that has confused people. And I think that's dismaying. And one of the jobs, one of the things that I'm doing is trying to help people understand what the difference really is between these bills and what it is that I support and that we're talking about when we say Medicare for All.
Right. So let's get into it a little bit, because the bill, there is a Medicare for All bill in Congress. On the Senate side, of course, it was introduced by Bernie Sanders. On the House side, I believe it was introduced by Pramila Jayapal. And this this version of Medicare for All, which I think is the pure one out there, calls for a complete shift away from our for-profit health insurance system to a Medicare for All system where everybody would go on Medicare for All, right? There might still be a health insurance industry that would be for supplemental insurance should somebody care to get it. Do I have that right?
Right. That's correct. And you would not really need supplemental insurance for anything that's medically necessary.
Right.
Supplemental coverage would be available only for elective procedures or things like cosmetic surgery. It's a very, very good bill. Actually, both of them are, both the House and the Senate version. They're not identical, but they're very, very close in the way they would set up an improved and expanded Medicare program. And it would it would be expanded not only to cover more people, but to cover also dental care and vision care,
right,
and hearing care and long-term care. So it's improved significantly, and also it would change the prescription drug benefits so that people would not be facing these high out-of-pocket costs for drugs that they need. And it also would eliminate the co-payment obligation in the current Medicare program. So a lot of the Medicare supplement program that a lot of Medicare beneficiaries buy to cover their out-of-pocket costs, there would be no need for that.
Right. And that's important. Look, my husband is on Medicare now, and so I've been living through it with him. I always had heard you don't want Medicare Advantage. You want a Medicare gap,
right,
insurance.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, right, the Medicare gap plans were so expensive, and we're not in a great financial position these days. And we had to think economically. And with Medicare Advantage, you get dental, you get vision for no additional copay. It's because we're subsidizing it. If you go for the actual, yeah, through these for-profit health insurance companies that can afford to, I guess, take a loss because they make so much money by administering these plans, where in Medicare, there is no padding on it. So, there's, 3% for overhead costs in Medicare, and it's over 20% in the for-profit health insurance industry. There would be no more Medicare Advantage. There would be Medicare, and there would be no more need for a gap policy because everything would be included, right? But the thing that people the media is focusing in on without, I think, explaining the other side of the issue is that your taxes will go up. Yes, so taxes will go up, but the difference is you won't have health insurance premiums, you won't have copays, you won't have deductibles to meet. And it will,
right,
it would sort of, I would think, even out or come pretty close to evening out in the wash. The savings on your premiums would go towards the increase in taxes where you're paying for your insurance. Nothing is free. Am I explaining it correctly?
You're exactly correct. And in fact, most people would be paying less and getting better coverage,
right,
than they're getting right now, because what is happening is that people who are getting their coverage through the private marketplace from companies like the ones I used to work for, every year the value of that coverage is going down in one way or another, but your premiums continue to go up. That will end. You will not see what is referred to in the insurance industry as benefit buy down, which is the term that covers a lot of sins in my view. Things like pushing people into high deductible plans,
right,
and increasing those deductibles every year and limiting the doctors and hospitals that they can go to, and requiring prior authorization for a lot of services.
Uh-huh.
So those things would be a thing of the past. I am sick and tired, to tell you the truth, Nicole, of people having to send their hard-earned money to health insurance company that skims off a big portion of what we pay them to pay executives exorbitant salaries and to reward their shareholders and to engage in very expensive lobbying and advertising campaigns. That's where a lot of our money is going to. That would end as well, too. So a lot of the money that we spend currently for health insurance and for healthcare overall is wasted. That would come to a halt.
Right. And so, again, while the media keeps focusing, because I guess they're depending on the health insurance industry advertising dollars to keep them going, all they focus on is your taxes are going to go up. But they don't talk about you're going to save all the money you're paying on premiums, deductibles, copays,
yeah,
and more. Now, not all there. We've got a plethora of people running for the Democratic presidential nomination, Wendell Potter. Although at the beginning of the campaign season, we're still at the beginning of it technically. Many of them were touting their support of Medicare for All. As you mentioned, there are also these like sort of Medicare for All light plans that are or Medicare light plans that are going around. Do you know where each of the candidates stands on Medicare for All? Is that part of your work at the institute that you're working at? I want to get the name right.
Right.
Business Initiative for Health Policy.
Yeah. Right. And by the way, our website is businessinitiative.org. We're a nonprofit organization. So, yes, we do track what the candidates are saying. And we're also working, Nicole, to provide information to the candidates to help set them straight, actually. Mayor Buttigieg, for example, has been talking about health care reform, but is not enthusiastic about Medicare for All and has said some negative things about it. So we're sending some information to his campaign to make sure that he really is better educated and has a better understanding of what it is we're talking about and why it's needed as well, too. But the candidates who've embraced it, who've signed on to one version of the bill or another, certainly the senators who are in the race, that have endorsed Medicare for All and has signed on actually as sponsors, co-sponsors of Bernie Sanders' bill. Certainly Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, Senator Harris, Senator Gillibrand, and I think, yes, and Senator Booker all are co-sponsors of the Medicare for All Act that Senator Sanders introduced.
They are, but this is where I see them sort of vacillating a little bit, because apparently
Cory
Booker is a co-sponsor of Debbie Stabenow's Medicare at 50 Act, which allows people aged 50 to 64 to buy into Medicare. He's also a co-sponsor of Sanders' bill, so it doesn't, he's not all in on it. He's sort of hedging his bets. And I've heard, and I'm sort of, I'm torn. I mean, I'm a big Bernie Sanders supporter. He's my number one guy, mostly because of Medicare for All, frankly. And Elizabeth Warren is my second choice, but she's also been very vague about it. Her campaign website apparently calls for a down payment. And at a town hall on CNN in March, she said she would get everybody at the table to, quote, figure out how to do Medicare for All, which she said could include a temporary role for private insurance companies. She seems to be vacillating on this. Do you have a clearer idea of where she stands?
I think, frankly, all of them except Bernie Sanders have vacillated in one way or another. Mm-hmm. So has Senator Harris, which is kind of troubling, but also kind of you have to understand that they're running to try to win as many votes as they can. And let's face it, my old industry and its allies, they're spending a lot of money to try to confuse people and influence the media coverage, influence the candidates to scare people away from the idea of Medicare for All. I've often said that what we are seeing, and we'll see more and more of it, is the mother of all propaganda campaigns, because, as we said at the top of the show, this is the first time that we've really had a serious debate on Medicare for All with many presidential candidates campaigning for it. And as you noted, some of them are waffling on that, and you're not really sure exactly where they stand. But just the fact that this legislation exists and a lot of candidates have signed on to it is scaring the heck out of my old colleagues in the industry. So they're behind a lot of this confusion, and these candidates know that these companies that I used to work for, in fact, they're allied with the drug companies and the big hospital chains in a propaganda campaign, and they know it's going to be relentless for the next several months into the right up to the election day.
Absolutely, and I think it's already starting. And unfortunately, so many people get their information from watching corporate media. And I wasn't joking when I said they depend on the advertising from these for-profit health insurance companies for their bottom line. And so that's why, you know, MSNBC, which is owned by Comcast, it has questionable bedfellows. There's a conflict of interest there. And maybe, you know, a commercial broadcasting system is not the right venue for political campaigns because, again, there's a conflict of interest. So they're already whipping, as it were, against Medicare for All. And we're seeing it. In fact, there's a story in the news this week where Third Way, which is this centrist group or right-wing group, really, that pretends to be, you know, bipartisan, pushes right-wing ideology, and they're blasting Sanders, basically pushing an anyone but Sanders meme out there. And in fact, Bernie responded in a way that was meant to be sort of a slam on Third Way, that they're saying was Bernie attacking Elizabeth Warren. They're trying to sow discord and make it around the Medicare for All issue. How do we get past that? We're dealing with the media behemoth here, but I mean, what should people do? Going to the website businessinitiative.org would be a good start, because you've got a lot of information there about Medicare for All. You want facts and not media spin.
You're exactly right, and there are a number of organizations that are really strongly supportive of this. The Business Initiative, for sure. Businessinitiative.org, and also I'll suggest that people take a look at Tarbell.org, which is a journalism organization that I founded. We're a nonprofit. We don't take advertising for the very reason you mentioned. We don't want to be influenced or even have the appearance of influence from big corporations and special interests like the commercial media and broadcast media. It is influenced by them. You can't turn on MSNBC or any channel without hearing and seeing countless ads from pharmaceutical companies and Medicare Advantage companies. So they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them, I'm afraid, as you well know. But Public Citizen is another organization that's very, very supportive of this. National Nurses United, Physicians for National Health Program, Healthcare Now. There are a number of good organizations that are sources of important information about both the legislation and the effort to win Medicare for All.
Great. You know, I just went over to Tarbell.org, and there's a new story up today. The headline reads, $74 million Big Pharma merger could be a power surge for Bristol-Myers Squibb. See, these are the kind of stories that we don't get in the mainstream corporate media. Right. And this is really important because, again, while Trump has been telling us he's already lowered prescription drug prices, that's bullshit. And nothing is being done. And these kind of mergers are still going through. And you need to go to a place like Tarbell.org to get the story.
Yeah, you're not going to get this kind of reporting in many other places, and we think it's very important. What we do is focus on these kinds of deals, these kinds of transactions, and how these companies spend money to influence public opinion and public policy and elections, and connect the dots for people so that we can understand what the consequences are of all those actions and that spending to maintain a very profitable status quo for them. The result is that we wind up paying dearly for it out of our own pockets when we go to the drugstore or go to the doctor.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's something to be concerned about or to think this is a move in the right direction. But CVS, for instance, is talking about putting walk-in clinics into their pharmacies. That may be the future of healthcare. I know it's really difficult to get in to see a primary care physician, at least where I live.
That is going to be something that we'll see more of. It's a trend that I don't think that can be stopped. And CVS, as you know, bought Aetna, or is trying. It hasn't.
Wow,
I don't think
right.
The deal has been finally approved yet, but it would be a big merger, big acquisition. And drug companies and even Walmart and other big retailers are looking to provide access to care. That can be helpful. On the other hand, these are for-profit entities that are setting these up, and we need to always know that. The upside is that hopefully they will be staffed with capable doctors and physician assistants and nurse practitioners, which I can't say enough about the importance of having those clinicians available to people as well, too.
Absolutely. Now, Wendell Potter, let me ask you this about when we get to Medicare for All. There are people who are concerned that basically an entire industry will be shut down. What happens to all those people who now work for these for-profit insurance companies? Can they transfer over? Obviously, Medicare will have a lot more work to do. Is that something that they can transfer, or are they all out of jobs?
No, it's a very good question, and I'll answer it in a couple of ways. One,
keep in mind that these companies have diversified a great deal over the years. They were diversifying when I was at Cigna and Humana before that. So a lot of the divisions of these companies are not involved in health insurance. They do other things. They collect and analyze and sell data, for example, and they have big pharmacy benefit management companies, which that too should go away. But a lot of the people who've been hired by these companies are doctors and nurses who, in many cases, the nurses are aptly called denial nurses. There are people who are working for insurance companies and their job primarily is to say no to people, you know, to doctors who are calling to get permission to get something paid for a patient. There's no need for that in this world. There is no other system that employs people like that, who are trained clinicians, who are actually standing as barriers to care than facilitators to care.
Right.
Those people can go back to serving patients and serving them at the beds, at, you know, in their offices and at bedside in hospitals. And I hope that happens. But also in both the Jayapal and Sanders bill, there's money that is set aside, significant amounts of money, to retrain people whose jobs would be displaced. A period of time in not only in retraining these people, but providing them money until they can find jobs for a certain period of time.
Good.
So that's been thought through. It's called Just Transition.
Gotcha. Well, there's one other concern, and this is raised by one of my favorite listeners, Sue in Illinois, who works in a rural hospital. Running, I believe, their pharmacy. And she said the Medicare reimbursement rates are so low that she fears her hospital and many others like it, if we go to a Medicare for All system, will be put out of business because they can't survive on the reimbursement rates. Is this something that's being discussed, that those rates will have to change?
Absolutely. And in fact, when you have an improved and expanded Medicare for All program, the reimbursement will absolutely be addressed and in many cases increased, certainly to make sure that rural hospitals are not continuing to close. I was back in my home state of Tennessee a couple of months ago, and just over the last few years, 12 rural hospitals in Tennessee have closed, pretty much devastating the communities where those hospitals were located. A lot of jobs have been lost, but access to care that's close by is now gone. And that is happening now, and part of that is because of the unequal and uneven reimbursement for services to rural areas. For there aren't many patients, and the patients are typically lower income. One of the things that is included in the legislation is this means of going to global budgeting to make sure that hospitals are getting the money that they need to keep their doors open.
Right. And that makes sense. Look, we know how they gouge us for services and tests and everything. I mean, I looked at the hospital bill after my hospitalization for lung cancer and surgery. I see what they charge for things. There's got to be a middle ground where they're paid a reasonable amount for services to cover expenses, to earn enough money to keep the hospital technologically up to speed, but also not gouging patients for care.
You're absolutely right. And really, the Medicare for All legislation before both the House and the Senate not only will get us to finally universal guaranteed health care, but it will truly address the inadequate spending and the inappropriate spending on health care in this country. We spend $3.5 trillion a year on health care, but a third of it is wasted, or at least is not going to provide care for people. It's going to cover administrative costs. That can go away, and that money can be redirected to make sure that people are getting appropriate care when they need it.
Absolutely. Wendell Potter, I always so appreciate time spent with you. I learn something every time we talk. Wendell Potter is on Twitter at Wendell Potter. You can also find him at, well, tarbell.org, which is a great independent news site that is nonprofit, listener or reader supported, and doing really important work. And at the Business Initiative for Health Policy, they're at businessinitiative.org. And again, Wendell, on behalf of the listeners, I thank you so much for the work you're doing, because it is really important, and I think it'll help us get to where we need to be eventually.
Well, Nicole, thank you so much, and thanks for the work that you continue to do to educate people, to help people keep it, stay informed and get information that is accurate and important to know.
You got it. As the campaign continues, I hope we can check in again and talk about, you know, where the both candidates are on this issue. Wendell Potter, thank you so much. It's great talking with you again. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. As always, thank you for listening. Tomorrow's Friday. My pal, your pal, Boca Brittany Summers will be here in studio to have fun on a Friday. Thank you, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.